KJZZ's original production, The Show, is supported by Banner Health, Arizona's largest nonprofit healthcare system. Last year, Banner reinvested more than $1.1 billion in community health and charity care. Banner Health, nonprofit for Arizona. BannerHealth.com/nonprofit4AZ.
Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the cost of rent is leveling off in Arizona, but people are still spending too much on housing.
And how AI can and maybe should be used in military operations.
But first, two Phoenix police officers have been arrested and fired after a violent off-the-books traffic stop in South Phoenix earlier this month. It was so violent, in fact, that when it was reported to a different police department, they thought it must have been done by criminals posing as police. The officers involved, Antonio Felix and Luis Vasquez Jr., did not activate their body-worn cameras, did not report use of force, and left one of the people involved on the side of the road alone. ABC 15 Chief Investigative Reporter Dave Bisping broke the story, and he sat down with Phoenix Police Chief Matt Giordano to talk more about how people in South Phoenix can trust the department, given its history there and this latest scandal. Good morning, Dave. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Good morning.
Okay, so this is a winding story. Start with what we know about this unreported traffic stop. What are the officers accused of doing exactly?
Well, like you just kind of broke down, they apparently rear-ended this car that the victims claim was following them. They claim the police were following them, and then it got very violent. According to the victims, they ripped off a window, tased them multiple times, held a gun at them, counted down from three after threatening to shoot them. The man is a man and woman. The man actually, like, he's a big guy. He's listed at 6-some feet, 300 some pounds, got away and the car drove off while they had the woman, I think, in custody already, or I should say had her, you know, handcuffed. But they left her just on the side of the road, and then the police didn't report this or pretend like it happened at all. And then once the man got into Tempe, he reported what had happened, and they thought, okay, this had to have been some sort of wild rip or criminals posing as cops. And that's how this all began.
Right. Okay. So they didn't report it. They said, actually, in court documents after they were arrested, that it was because they knew they had broken so many Phoenix PD policies, right?
That's their explanation. A lot of their explanation, and it's not much based on what we've seen documented that their side of this was, but it doesn't really add up when it's held up to all of the other facts.
Yeah. Okay. So you sat down with Phoenix Police Chief Matt Giordano, who what does he say about what the department's doing in this particular case and you know, making sure these officers haven't done this before and it's never come to light?
So his steps he has announced and told us in our interview are to both investigate these officers specifically, kind of scrub down their work history, but then also have their integrity unit take a deeper look at the South Mountain Precinct and the unit, et cetera, to see if there are some systemic issues. So that is what he says they are doing.
Okay. What about other officers at Phoenix PD? I've never heard of a so-called off-the-book traffic stop. Is this a thing that happens?
I am getting some source information from multiple police sources that indicates that this, while not maybe being carried out in the way that these officers did this, quote, off the book stop, there is something known as ghost stops. And that is that officers, maybe when they don't want to have to document a stop because they don't think it's severe enough or they just don't want to, or for whatever reason, they don't activate their body cameras, they don't call it in, and they maybe are, you know, maybe it's something as innocuous as giving someone kind of just a verbal warning, or, I mean, in the most extreme sense, is it what we're doing here? And I do want to say, we use the word traffic stop because that's how Phoenix has described it. But
right.
traffic stop implies there's some sort of legitimacy that is what happened with these two officers. And, you know, as of right now, the evidence does not show that. So that's just for a lack of a better term.
Yeah. You also asked the chief about a string of incidents with other officers at the South Mountain precinct where these two officers were based. And this precinct in particular seems to have a culture problem. You described it as out of control. What did the chief have to say about that?
Well, my sources say that precinct has a reputation from being out of control, right? And this stems back from far to more recent. And, you know, we're talking about Richard Chrisman, who back in 2010 shot a man in the back and was charged with murder, ended up getting about, I think, 10 years in prison mm-hmm. for that. Then right after that, very close, there was another officer, Sean Drenth, who was found dead in a kind of a warehouse kind of parking lot area. They've never figured out or determined whether or not that was a suicide or a murder, meaning perhaps a cop killed him because they mm-hmm. were all involved in an off-duty work scheme. Flash forward to now, we have, you know, the sergeant from that precinct who was trying to bait the students at that ICE protest. He was fired. And now we have this. So I asked the chief, you know, what is there a culture problem here? He says, no, I came up through this precinct. You know, there's a lot of great men and women there, but, you know, many in the community in that area, it's a very divisive relationship between people in South Phoenix and the police department. Yeah. And there's no doubt that just pretending that there isn't an issue is going to allay any of those concerns.
Okay, last minute here, Dave. This is coming after the Phoenix PD and the chief pushed back against the Department of Justice under former President Joe Biden. They released a scathing report about the department's use of force and more. The Trump administration dropped that investigation. The Phoenix PD was happy about that. But what does this story say about the kind of debate over that DOJ report and if it should have been closed with no action?
You know, for the public, for us in the news who report on Phoenix, for everyone, the question is, how much longer can we take what Phoenix says, leadership at every level, from the city manager's office to the mayor to the council to the police department, and say, hey, we can police ourselves when something like this could happen? They keep asking for our trust. They keep saying that they can do it. Then why do things like this keep happening? We still have a disproportionate number of police shootings and killings compared to any other major police department in the country. We have these massive scandals and these things keep happening, and yet they keep asking for trust and patience.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, you know, does that just become, if it isn't already, just completely hollow?
Yeah. ABC 15 Chief Investigative Reporter Dave Biskobing joining us. I'm sure he'll be following this story. Thank you, Dave. Appreciate your reporting here.
Thank you.
The Trump administration this month proposed changes to the Head Start program. That's the National Early Childhood Education Program for low-income families. Essentially, the changes would give states more control over Head Start, moving many of those decisions away from the federal government. NPR reports a Health and Human Services official said one-size-fits-all mandates from Washington can't fully account for the reality of the 1,600 providers nationwide. Under the proposed changes, there would be a cap on how much money Head Start centers could spend on administrative overhead. There would also be a reduction in the number of regulations governing the program, among other changes. But some providers aren't happy about these changes. Eve Del Real is one of them. She's president of the Arizona Head Start Association and joins me now to talk more about this. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So what about these changes like doesn't sit well with you and some of the or maybe many of the providers here in Arizona?
Well, I think it's important to highlight that Head Start was designed to provide services for those most vulnerable in our communities. And when we say those most vulnerable, it's for children experiencing homelessness, children in foster care, children with disabilities. The proposal would initially rescind and replace the current Head Start performance standards that provide the safeguards to these protections that are in place to provide a high quality experience for children. It would eliminate, for example, federal staff to child ratios and group size limitations, which we know are essential to providing a high quality experience for children.
Could the state not just put those same kinds of standards back in place?
No, actually. So here in the state of Arizona, there is no cap on group size. So when we make a comparison of some of the quality measures that we have in the services we're providing, even if we followed state statutes, it would significantly reduce the quality that we're providing, again, for children that have higher needs.
Is that something that, in theory at least, could be changed by the legislature?
It could be. I mean, it's something that we could always help advance and support. That would be phenomenal. But currently, as the statutes lie within Arizona, there's a significant difference in the support that we're providing versus what the state has in place.
Are there some decisions that you think it would be better if the state could make on its own as opposed to having them being dictated from Washington? If not, you know, as the Trump administration is proposing, basically everything being sent down to the states?
Well, I mean, I think that the NPRM is so complicated. There's again some complexity with the way it's even written. I think that removing certain things, even such as the detailed requirements for developmental screenings, for disability services, health, mental health, has a huge impact on our ability, though, to identify children with higher needs and refer them then on to maybe additional state level interventions. So it's very complex. So it just depends on what it is. And then again, the funding that's related to that, it's challenging, I think, for the state to be able to compensate for some of those interventions that we're already providing.
Yeah, let me ask you about the money aspect here. I mean, is there a sense among Head Start operators here that if these changes were to go into effect, that there would be less money for Head Start generally?
Yes, there would be less. Especially as we're looking at the proposal with the administrative cost ceiling from a 15% now to a 5%, it would be extremely challenging for a Head Start program to continue providing services at the level that, again, we're mandated to, even with this proposed reduction, because of the support that's necessary within the classroom settings and within family services as well.
Are there Head Start operators in Arizona that, even if things stay exactly as they are potentially at risk of closing because they can't afford to continue doing it?
I think that the risk is always there for any Head Start program because there are other conditions that we're currently experiencing. I mean, because we know there was the closure of the federal office last year, there are many Head Start grantees that are still experiencing delays and changes of scope and other federal actions that always jeopardize, timely funding.
How has enrollment been in Arizona over the last, let's say, couple of years? I mean, is it fairly steady? Have you seen a decline, an increase?
After the pandemic, I know that many grantees at a national level were struggling with enrollment. However, here in Arizona, we serve 17,000 children, and many grantees here in the state have an extensive wait list. So for us, I mean, the call to provide the service is definitely there, and it would be a huge loss to the state if Head Start were ever eliminated.
Okay, so I mean, what do providers say? Let's say that these changes from the Trump administration go into effect. What would Head Start look like in Arizona that would be different than what it looks like now?
It would significantly water down the service. I mean, we would be equivalent to childcare without the comprehensive service delivery model. Keeping in mind that Head Start again is not childcare, it is high quality early education with embedded supports that include the disability services, the health, the dental, the mental health services. But then also considering that we employ a highly qualified workforce. So when you put all of that together, we're providing these beautiful, safe environments that lead to these individualized learning experiences for children. It's very different than a typical childcare model.
Is there also a concern, as we've heard in other areas, where, if you have to get rid of the education component of that, that children enter kindergarten, for example, less prepared to be there?
Yes, they would definitely enter less prepared. I mean, we have 6 decades of evidence that shows that Head Start improves school readiness. It increases high school graduation and college enrollment. It connects children to health, and again, it produces lasting gains in adult earnings and even family stability.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Yves Del Real, president of the Arizona Head Start Association. Yves, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how involved should artificial intelligence be in military operations? A lawyer who served as general counsel for the Army and Air Force weighs in.
But first, they may not always be in the headlines these days, but immigration raids are still taking place here and all over the country. And in photos taken outside a recent raid in a Tucson neighborhood, our next guest spotted something a little out of the ordinary. A truck with the letters DEA on the side. That's the Drug Enforcement Administration, an agency that isn't traditionally involved in immigration enforcement. Yana Kunichoff is a reporter with Arizona Luminaria in Tucson, and she's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Yana.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So DEA was spotted at this Tucson raid. Why did this stand out to you?
Yeah, I think that what we have seen is a shift in, under the Trump administration, we've seen a shift in the agencies that have been involved in immigration enforcement. And we've also seen a lot of unmarked vehicles, officers who are not wearing tags saying what agency they're connected to, involved in immigration enforcement at the ground level. Mm-hmm. So this really stark sign of a federal agency that doesn't usually do this work really caught my eye.
What does the Drug Enforcement Administration normally do? I mean, obviously, drug enforcement, right? Different kind of work.
Yeah. So the DEA is usually, kind of looking at, are there cartel operations? Are there drug trafficking operations? It's part of the effort to get fentanyl pills off of the streets. There's kind of this bigger international or national view of tracking criminal organizations. And that is really, really different to arresting folks for civil immigration purposes.
Right, right. Okay, so this is not the traditional role of the DEA, but it does seem like this could be kind of the new normal as you're getting out there. Tell us about what Attorney General Chris Mays has had to say about this. She mentioned this in a different interview, right?
Yeah, and so it's been actually some of this came up about a year ago when the Trump administration deployed officers from a number of different agencies, including the IRS, including FEMA, which is emergency management, to immigration enforcement. And the move with the DEA was part of that. So we're seeing this big growth in the immigration enforcement agenda. And then some of these other more traditional other enforcement work. There's just less of that happening. And Chris Mays, a year ago, wrote a letter to the federal government saying, hey, this is actually impacting my ability to fight crime at the border. This is impacting my ability to fight cartels at the border. I need more agents. And at the time, she said there were 60 agents who had been deployed out of Arizona to other places.
Right. There was also a Cato Institute report showing almost half of DEA agents had been shifted to immigration enforcement last year. And as you say, we've seen this similar pattern play out from the Trump administration when it comes to other agencies that are not normally charged with immigration, like FEMA. There was a recent report from House Democrats and Representative Greg Stanton from here in Arizona that shed light on how the Trump administration had shifted workers at FEMA to immigration enforcement as well. And the House Democrats there said that was an illegal move.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is really what has been the impact of this now, essentially over the last year. So that GAO report, there were two things that really stood out to me. One was the Texas floods last year, when 137 people died in July, that there was a lapse contract for call centers. So when people were making calls to look for support, no one was answering those calls because of some of those FEMA cuts, which included moving staff to work in detention centers or help hire officers, jobs that are just outside of their usual position as FEMA employees.
Yeah. Did ICE or the DEA here have anything to say to you about this particular story?
ICE sent me to the DEA, and the DEA did not give me an on-the-record comment. So I don't have anything to share that can help us understand this better, besides what we've kind of seen in this shift in, there's been some reporting around, okay, so white collar criminal investigations are going down. There's sort of numbers about the impact of this in other spaces, but otherwise, no.
Okay. Back up for a moment, Yana, and tell us what this issue looks like on the ground right now. Like, you're in Tucson, you're near the border, but this is happening, as I said, all over the country. Are you seeing more immigration raids still happening in Tucson, even though they don't always make headlines?
Oh, absolutely. And I think what I'm hearing, there's a pretty broad network of rapid response volunteers on the ground here who try to go out to whenever there's an alleged raid. They try to be there on the ground. And I'm hearing that those are happening pretty regularly. They're also happening very early in the morning. The raid that I wrote about 2 weeks ago, there was actually a volunteer who saw people going to what they believed was another raid while they were on their way to the first one. So that just tells me that the density of these occurring are high, but it's also really hard to get information about it when I've asked immigration or when I've asked ICE for comment, if I don't have the full name and the A number or the date of birth of a person arrested in that, they won't comment on it. So there's not a lot of ability to get official information.
Yeah, and difficult to track on any kind of mass level. What are you watching for on this front going forward, Yana, in terms of this major shift in law enforcement priorities and what agencies are doing the work, but also just the work that's going kind of unnoticed?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always a trickle down in communities from this. I'm wondering what this looks like in schools. I'm wondering what this means for how people interact with local law enforcement, sort of what it means for the fabric of our communities here in Tucson to have this level of enforcement. And I think also that people are seeing something happen in their communities, but is that reflected in media coverage, or are they able to get information about what happens? I think that just impacts public trust in a broad way.
Yeah, raises lots of questions there. Yana Kunichoff is a reporter with Arizona Luminaria joining us from Tucson. Yana, thanks for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. A new robo-taxi service started taking fares this month. Zoox, which is owned by Amazon, is now collecting payment in Las Vegas. It had been operating for free there for several months. My next guest describes the cars as kind of a cute toaster on wheels, in that they're square and boxy but look like they have a personality. Joanne Muller is transportation correspondent at Axios, where she writes the Future of Mobility newsletter. I spoke with her earlier, and we started with what's different about this company and their vehicles from what folks may be familiar with other autonomous vehicles.
Well, Zoox started out, it was a startup like everybody else, and they got purchased by Amazon at a time when they probably really needed the extra capital. It was an interesting acquisition at the time. Everyone assumed, myself included, that Amazon wanted to buy Zoox so that they could deliver packages with the Zoox robo-taxi. But in fact, it's always been focused on passengers and ride-hailing. And what's different about Zoox from other autonomous vehicle companies like Waymo is that they are doing it all. They designed a vehicle from the ground up that is meant to be a robo-taxi. It's not like they're putting self-driving technology onto an existing car, which is what Waymo has done. If you've ever ridden in a Waymo, you watch as the steering wheel turns miraculously by itself. There is no steering wheel in a Zoox, and there's no brake pedals. There's no human controls at all. And so they call that a purpose-built robo-taxi. But Zoox is different for other reasons in that they are, besides designing the vehicle, they're manufacturing it. They're going to operate their own depots. They're controlling the experience inside the vehicle. And so it is, a very vertically oriented strategy, but probably comes with some more risk that way as well.
Yeah. So why are they deciding, or why did they decide to roll out in Vegas as opposed to anywhere else?
I don't know exactly. I mean, Nevada is one of the few states that's been very friendly toward autonomous technology, even from the beginning. Texas is another one. So you see a lot of robo-taxis in Texas. As far as Las Vegas, it's a relatively concentrated area. The Strip, we all know what the Strip is like. And these vehicles can kind of go from one popular destination to another. It doesn't go everywhere. Zoox has started small, but there's enough demand, I think, in that concentrated area that they can, really get some volume going.
What will it take for Zoox to be like a real competitor to a company like Waymo, which seems to have a foothold in a lot of communities already, including here in Phoenix.
Yeah. Well, Waymo has an enormous head start on everyone. Zoox has about 110 vehicles right now. Waymo has like 3,500, almost 4,000 in 11 cities. So, you know, what will it take? It will take time. It will take a lot of technology to continue building out what they're doing. I think Zoox is very different. They just are. They're going to be slower and more deliberate. They've got their cars running in San Francisco now. And then they've also targeted, I believe, Austin and Miami as their next markets. But they're still, you know, what Zoox does is they have a traditional car with their software on it, and they drive around and kind of do all the training with a normal car. But then they have to deploy the vehicle itself, and so that takes another sort of layer of testing for the vehicle itself to deploy, and it will be slow. And so, honestly, I don't know that Zoox will catch up to Waymo.
Hmm. Do you get the sense, and maybe is there a sense in the AV world that certain cities may just be like one horse towns? Like, might Zoox just decide, look, in a place like Phoenix, Waymo has this, as you referenced, this enormous head start. It's maybe not worth it to go there. Let's try somewhere that doesn't have autonomous vehicles already.
I think you've identified something that is very real consideration, because let's face it, there's not that many, like each city's not going to need that many robo-taxis. You know, they will be generally focused on the center city, and so they just kind of zip around back and forth, and they're in constant motion. You don't need, you know, 1,000 or 5,000 of these in one city. So once a company gets a foothold, there might be room for another one, maybe three total, but I don't think that you can have a lot of players in each city.
You also write, Joanne, about Zoox maybe doing things a little differently in terms of their safety data and sort of giving potential riders a look, pardon the pun, under the hood. Like, what are they doing differently there?
Well, just this week, Zoox released what's called its safety case framework. It sounds very jargony and so forth. And only a couple companies have done the same thing, Waymo being one, and Aurora, which is a autonomous trucking company. But what they're trying to do is just show the public and, frankly, the policymakers how they evaluate their own safety, because there are no federal regulations for autonomous vehicles. The Department of Transportation, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, is beginning to work on performance standards for AVs. But this is many years away, 3, 4, 5, who knows how many years it will take. For the time being, these AV developers kind of largely determine themselves when their cars are safe. And so we have no idea how they decide that. And so transparency is very important.
Have you ridden in a Zoox?
I have. I've ridden in a Zoox in San Francisco, and I was with some Zoox officials at the time, doing an interview, in fact, in the back of in the car. What's nice about a Zoox is it's sort of I call it like a high tech stagecoach. The seats, seats face each other, right? So can have a conversation. There's four seats, and some people have to ride backwards, and the vehicle itself is bi-directional, so there's no front or back. It doesn't do U-turns. It just gets somewhere, and then it just begins going in the opposite direction.
Oh wow!
Now the front is the back is the front, and it was San Francisco is a very complicated city to drive around in, and there's all those hills and intersections and stoplights and stop signs, and it was good. It was quite good. You know, there were one or two moments where I was like, oh, this is a little uneven, let's say. But generally speaking, it was fantastic. And it was a funny thing that happened. There was a car that was kind of tailgating the robo-taxi. And the robo-taxi, the Zoox robo-taxi, honked and
really?
Said, basically, get off my tail.
Oh, my gosh.
I thought that was quite interesting. I had never experienced that before.
All right. That is Joanne Muller, transportation correspondent at Axios, where she writes the Future of Mobility newsletter. Joanne, thanks as always. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Arizona has been facing a housing crisis since the Great Recession, and the latest annual State of Housing in Arizona report from the state's three public universities shows some encouraging signs, but it also shows we are still a long way from solving the problem. Allison Cook Davis is research director at the Morrison Institute for Public Policy at ASU, as well as co-director of the Arizona Research Center for Housing and Economic Solutions. I got her on the line to tell us more about it, beginning with one of those encouraging signs. Housing construction is at a decade high. Is it enough?
2024 was a good year for construction. So, like, that's really a good sign. But we, you know, we still see that, you know, household growth is consistently outpacing housing growth. And we're still kind of playing catch up from the shortage that has sort of, you know, started from, you know, this recession on.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming. So construction is coming, but not enough. And I'm sure the barriers to that have to do with, you know, the economic reality right now. Like everything else, including construction, costs more.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the construction costs have continued to increase. We've also seen, you know, higher interest rates, which, you know, is also very constraining. And so, yeah, these things kind of mount up. There's also been, a number of challenges around just sort of having the workforce, and the cost of building has reflected that.
Yeah. Okay. Another silver lining highlighted in your report is to do with rental costs, which might sound surprising to anyone who's paying rent in the Valley right now, but they are leveling off, right?
Yes. The most recent numbers show that you know, year over year, they're still increasing, but it has the lowest increase since like 2021.
Okay.
And so what that suggests is that we are seeing this sort of leveling off, maybe like a little bit of moderation here. And I think this is a good news for renters to some extent. And that is reflected also in the housing cost burden has lowered slightly, but it's still over 50%.
Right. Yeah. And you still find that over half of renters spend 30% or more of their income on housing, which is sort of that, you know, that recommended amount you're supposed to spend on housing, and that the state needs just a ton of affordable rental units that we do not have. 90,000.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's really where the crunch is, the sort of bottom of the market where you have like the extremely low and very low income households. That's where there is just not enough units, and you can't build, you know, homes at those price points. And so it really becomes a need for preservation, for other sort of strategies for being able to provide housing.
Okay, let's talk about the home buying market, Allison, because this is another kind of sticking point here. There was one stat in this section that really made me start. The U.S. median age of first-time home buyers has reached a record high of 40 years old. I mean, that's like wildly different than it was just a generation ago. What's that look like here?
Yeah, I don't have the numbers for Arizona, unfortunately. I only have the national numbers, but it is stark in the sense that I think that the median age for first-time home buyers was about 31 a decade ago.
Right.
So it's changed rather dramatically. And so the number of first-time home buyers has actually decreased quite a little bit. And we have seen that, you know, that just the home values have gone up so quickly over time here in Arizona. And even compared to some of our other, you know, close by states, I mean, we're like 66% increase in the last decade.
Yeah, which anybody looking at the housing market here has seen, right? The prices have just skyrocketed. Has that begun to even out as well? Will they ever go down?
That's a really good question. I mean, the short answer is probably not 66%.
Right. Never that much.
And I think it's worth noting, like, I think that one of the things in the report was also kind of stark was looking at just sort of like residential home sales prices over time over the past decade, and just sort of seeing the change where, you know, we saw, you know, about 40% of homes that were selling between 100 and 200,000. And now in 2025, that's only like 5% of the sales.
Wow.
So you're seeing like a lot fewer of those kind of like entry level homes.
Yeah.
And wages haven't really kept up with these sort of really fast increases.
Yeah. You also look in this report at homelessness in the state, and we have seen the rates of homelessness here rise a ton in recent years and more than in other kind of comparable Sun Belt states you found. And talk about the connection between the reality of people living on the street, which all of us see every day when we're driving around or walking around the city, and these kind of big picture housing challenges.
It is kind of the worst manifestation of housing unaffordability. And Arizona also saw a rise in unsheltered homelessness,
right,
which was particularly difficult to see. The reality is like these, you know, sort of constraints, the sort of increase of, you know, unaffordability, you know, what that means for different folks. Like some people may have to rent longer and not to be able to get into a home, and some people just may not have a home. This is the sort of like continuum of these sort of challenges.
Yeah.
And so this really is a housing affordability problem.
Yeah, that's really an interesting way to look at it, that we don't always kind of put it into that lens. Let me ask you lastly, Allison, about the big picture here in terms of, like, we always think about Arizona, the valley, the county here as like the fastest growing place in the country, this incredibly booming metropolis, which it still is, you find here. But that pace of growth seems to be slowing. And because of that, like the population here is becoming more diverse. That all kind of leads to housing challenges as well.
Yeah, we do continue as a state to grow. I mean, Arizona gained about 67,000 residents in 2025.
Yeah.
We have seen international migration decline substantially from 2024. But even that sort of the net growth has slowed down. But we still are seeing our, like, you know, sort of household formation is outpacing the, you know, sort of units that are being brought on the online. So all of these things add up to like sort of, you know, where are we going to be? And I can't predict that, but we are, you know, we're definitely, we could be, you know, 9 million by like 2030, you know?
Wow. And that will mean that the demand for housing changes and continues to go up, but also that we need different kinds of housing, right? Like we need those entry-level homes that you talked about us not having enough of. But we also need homes for seniors, things like this that we don't think about necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a kind of a big part of the sort of demographic shift, too, where we've seen just this shift in having, you know, older Arizonans. And so it is top of mind and sort of thinking about what that means in aging in community and being able to like have the place and space to be able to age where you live. Sometimes, you know, folks are looking to potentially downsize, but those like smaller, easily accessible homes are not always easy to find. And even if you're in a home that you have, you know, owned for, you know, a long period of time, moving can be very challenging, but then having a place to move to that sort of fits your needs, it can be possibly, you know, the constraining factor in being able to do that.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Allison Cook Davis, Research Director with the Morrison Institute for Public Policy at ASU. She's co-director for the Arizona Research Center for Housing and Economic Solutions, this ARCHES report. Allison, thanks very much for coming on. Thanks for walking us through all of this. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. AI has been changing many areas of public life, including in the military. The Washington Post reports the U.S. used the most advanced AI at the start of the war in Iran than it's ever used before. It's a subject my next guest has been thinking about, too. Chuck Blanchard is senior counsel at the law firm Arnold & Porter and is a former general counsel of both the Army and Air Force. He's also served in the Arizona Senate. He wrote about this recently in a Substack titled "Ban Killer Robots, AI, and the Military." Blanchard joins me to talk more about this. And Chuck, what got you thinking about this at this time?
Well, I was heavily involved in the issue when I was general counsel of the Air Force. because there was a lot of discussion at the time in 2013, 2014 on what the department should be doing about autonomous weapon systems. But at the time, I think the feeling was this was all theoretical because we just didn't have the technological capability to make AI really be something we'd be comfortable with in the battlefield. And then I watched AI just explode in the last few years. I've seen how my law firm and other law firms are using it. I know clients are using it effectively. I've seen the capabilities. And so it made me think we need to go back to rethink exactly how should we approach autonomous weapon systems.
Could you back in, 2013, let's say, have envisioned what AI has become and the way that it could be used in weapons?
AI was already beginning to be used by DoD. It certainly was used in intelligence analysis. So the issue was, is the AI so capable that we would trust an autonomous system to make attack decisions without a human in the loop? And at the time, the answer was no, that we don't trust the technology. We don't think it could comply with international law.
Do you draw a distinction between using AI, for example, to make decisions about who or what to attack and using AI to actually do the attacking?
Yes, and I think most of the community on both sides believe that there is an important distinction. We already depend heavily on machines to help identify targets, to say this is the enemy, this is not the enemy. And the best example is as a pilot in an F-35 never sees an enemy aircraft. They are too far away. What they do see are radar signals that are interpreted by a computer based on a library of signatures to identify that's the enemy, that's not the enemy, that's a commercial aircraft. And so we already depend on that kind of issue. But we also depend on a pilot making a decision. If it doesn't look right, if the computer is telling them doesn't look right, the human being can say, no, I'm not going to fire. And it was interesting at a conference I was at in England in 2014 that everyone seemed to agree that the critical issue was whether or not there was a human ultimately making the targeting decision. The use of computers or technology or AI to help assist a human being is not really the moral or legal issue. It's whether or not we completely eliminate the role of a human being in the process.
Well, but as you write, it seems like humans could, at least in theory, eliminate themselves, right? Like they could just trust the AI over their own judgment. And so even though there is a human in the loop, their role is limited to non-existent.
Exactly. And so in response to that, you have to sort of train your pilots or your warfighters, that they got to be careful about over-relying on the technology. That's a reality. And probably for a Patriot missile system that's on automatic mode, it's very likely that human beings are going to defer to the machine because the times are just so short for a missile coming in that they really can't be effective human interaction. But at least in that case, what you're firing on is a piece of metal, a missile. You're not firing on another human being. But I think it does become more problematic if you're talking about air defense systems that attack aircraft where there is a human being there. And this does become becomes a concern that you train your folks to use their judgment and not just check their judgment at the door because a machine is telling them what ought to be done.
Yeah. Do these questions become different in some way when you're talking about an air war or a sea war as opposed to like actual human soldiers on a battlefield?
Yeah, I think actually the land warfare where you have a lot of civilians mixed in and you have cities that raises significant compliance issues with international law. So the law of war requires lots of really tough judgments. It becomes very difficult in a land war where there's lots of civilians. So I think we may be getting close to where we can comply with international law in the air domain and naval domain against air targets and against naval targets. I think we're still much further away when we're talking about ground war, which of course still raises the more philosophical issue is, should we still do it even if we're capable of complying with international laws? There's something still morally wrong with allowing machine to make life and death decisions.
I'm curious where you come down on that question.
I think there should be a high threshold for the use of autonomous weapons. And the threshold is not only we have to be doubly sure we can comply, but we also have to make doubly sure that there's a there's a reason to use AI. It's not just a lazy reliance on machines, but there's a real compelling military reason to do so. And if those both are met, however, I personally think that as long as human beings have some decision-making process, such as we're going to attack in this geographical area legitimate military targets, I think this is not that far away from where we already are from a legal point of view.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's a difference, and we've talked about this and you alluded to it, like there's a difference between, for example, an autonomous drone being sent in to Ukraine or Iran or wherever, and, you know, whether, as you know, you sometimes see in sci-fi movies, like a walking humanoid robot with a machine gun that can just go and shoot anything in its sight.
Right. Although, ironically, if you look at the most common violations of the law of war, it tends to be by human beings in land war, because emotions take over, fear takes over, rage takes over. And so you can imagine a future AI machine that is not going to get angry, is not going to be fearful, is going to be more willing to take risks to itself in order to avoid harm to civilians. You can imagine a sophisticated AI fighting machine. I don't think we have them there. We're not there yet, but you can imagine that would occur. And then the difficult situation is, if we know that these machines are going to be more protective of civilian lives than a human being, should we use them for the very reason of protecting civilian lives? Or is the notion of a scary looking robot on the battlefield making life and death decisions, is that really going too far?
All right. That is Chuck Blanchard, senior counsel at Arnold and Porter. Chuck, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.